Hi there, folks, and welcome to the Photo Wild Podcast.
I'm Annalise Kaler.
And I'm Jared Lloyd. We created the Photo Wild Podcast to blend together the art and science of wildlife photography. Each episode brings you stories from the field, from the technical considerations to the natural history of the subjects we work with. If you want to become a better wildlife photographer, then this is the podcast for you. All right, folks, well, welcome back, or should I say thanks again for listening, or whatever the case is, to the Photo Wild Podcast. My name is Jared Lloyd.
I'm Annalise Kaler.
If you haven't figured this out yet, we are going to be your host tonight, today, this morning, whenever it is that you're actually listening to this. And we are back from Panama, finally. Actually, we've technically been back from Panama. It's just, let's just say, been crazy after being in Panama for a month, then getting back up to Alaska, and then preparations for heading back to the lower 48, Yellowstone workshops, something about, I don't know, a Christmas in the middle somewhere in the dates, I think.
Yeah, well, I'm actually going to stay up here for Christmas, but I'll be coming down right after. And yeah, we've got a lot going on. It feels like you and I have talked about this before. When you do this full time for a living, sometimes it feels like you don't actually pay attention to calendar dates as much as you pay attention to things like, well, the rut's happening, so it must be this time of year, or, you know, oh, it's this time of year by what species we're photographing. So it is that time of year. We're going to head back down to the lower 48, get ready for Yellowstone. But in the meantime, we have a couple of episodes about Panama coming up, and this is the first of them.
Yes, it is. So what are we going to talk about?
Today, we are going to be talking about all about our experience in the cloud forest, which is exciting. I know you're excited to talk about the forest in particular. And we've got some interesting birds to talk about, as well as some photography and how you can make your photography a little bit more exciting when it comes to framing up some more static subjects, if you will.
When you say cloud forest, you know, we should probably start out with a set and setting here. You know, normally, kind of like we normally do with these podcasts. So for everybody that's not familiar with a cloud forest, first and foremost, this is a truly unique sort of habitat ecosystem or whatnot. Around the world, these types of forests only make up about 1% of forest types in the world. And while most people think about Panama, or when they think of going to the tropics, they don't typically picture exactly what a cloud forest is, of course. Now, if you've been to Ecuador for hummingbirds, or let's say you've been to Monteverde and Costa Rica, then you're familiar with these cloud forest types, right? But down here in Panama, most people don't think of cloud forests in Panama, but that is part of the beauty, I think, of this country. You know, it really truly is one of the most biologically diverse places in the world, you know, standing as the isthmus, if you will, between the, you know, North America and South America. It's that land bridge that connects both of these continents together. And you have everything from these extraordinary, beautiful tropical islands that we actually do workshops out to. And then you have these high elevation forests that basically become bathed in clouds and fog, you know, year round. And so where we worked at in this particular trip down to Panama, we were at about 8,000 feet up for most of our photography. And that truly creates just an extraordinarily different sort of experience when it comes to being in these locations. So at 8,000 feet, first off, you should probably understand that that means mornings start at about 45 degrees and the highs for the day are, you know, 65, 70 degrees or something like that. In fact, we actually had to build a fire one night just to stay warm.
Yes, much to your dismay. You love building the fire. You hate the heat that comes with it.
Yes and no. I mean, you know, up here in Alaska and Montana, you know, Wyoming, stuff like that, it's snowfall outside. I absolutely love fire. But there is this thing for me. It's like, well, you know, it's October, November. I'm in the tropics. Should I have a fire? Yes, I want to build a fire. No, I don't want the heat to deal with it.
Yeah, it was actually really nice, though. It made for really, really comfortable days in the field. It made the hot coffee in the morning all the better. And it meant that we could, you know, photograph birds and enjoy the area without sweating like we normally do when we're in other parts of the country where it's just, you know, we walk outside and instantaneously you're just soaked.
That's kind of the interesting thing, especially when we do trips to the tropics where we start out in the lowland rainforest and then we end up in the cloud forest or vice versa. Like trying to pack for one of these trips can be, let's just say it's an exercise in frustration, right? Because like on the one hand, you have to prepare for 85 to 90 degree temperatures, you know, Fahrenheit, of course, with 99% humidity, which regardless of Celsius or Fahrenheit, I think everybody knows what that means. And so, you know, we end up with like very particular hot weather gear for, you know, in preparation for working in the rainforest, for hiking and trekking through the heat and humidity and all that sort of stuff. And then we hop on a little plane and we fly to a different part of the country and we go up into the mountains and everything dramatically changes. Like I said, mornings start out in the 40s. So, you know, switching from like closed-toed sandals and, you know, perforated, you know, t-shirts and stuff like that to hiking boots and jeans and windbreakers and polar fleeces. And if you're Annalise, you know, stocking caps and mittens and neck warmers.
Hand warmers
and snow boots. And I think you brought your snowshoes at this point, didn't you?
Sure, we'll go with that.
Okay. Well, anyways, so yeah, it's just such a dramatically different climate when you get to this sort of elevation. And just like we experience those temperatures differently, so too does, well, all of nature. And so that means that the animals, the birds, the plants, the amphibians, the reptiles, the insects, you name it, everything that lives at these sort of elevations have to actually be cold adapted, which is just kind of a mind-blowing concept to me personally. I don't know about you, but to think that you have to have cold adapted species in Panama, you know, right next to the equator, essentially.
And when you've got the Caribbean on one side and the Pacific on the other, like, it's just kind of like you don't ever really think of cold adapted species when you're thinking about this area.
No, you really don't. But that is kind of like, that's a good point though, right? Because like up on top of these mountain ridges that we're working in, you can literally see the Caribbean when you turn one direction and then you turn the other and you can see the Pacific Ocean. And I mean, it's just amazing how narrow of a little sliver of land. I mean, like Panama is only about the size of the state of South Carolina in the United States. And the whole thing is shaped like just a big snake, essentially, which I personally like given my affinity for snakes, mm-hmm. stuff like that, obviously.
Yes. So I want to kind of get back because this is actually an interesting thing, this little sliver of mountains that we're talking about, right? And this is exactly why we are in this spot, is because we have gone to this area specifically to photograph species that we are only going to find in this area. We're focused on some endemics and some rarity endemics even at that. So you know, you'll have like a lot of the more common species that you know are endemic to this area or specifically only live in this area. And then you have some of those that are even more rare within the category of the endemic. So something that I was very excited about, you know, we're in this beautiful, incredible cloud forest. We're seeing all sorts of birds. I don't even know how many. I think on this entire trip I saw, you know, and considering we were like just outside of this region and kind of stuck in a spot for the majority of the trip, I think I had like 117 species I logged total. And I think there were something like 90 of them came just from this particular spot in the cloud forest.
Cough, bird nerd, cough.
Yes. So as a bird nerd, this thrilled me. And I was really excited because we got to see some rarities that as a birder, I was just excited to see, right? So the ochraceous peewee normally stays up in the overstory. You very rarely see photographs of this bird from Panama. I think there's like 3 on the internet, and that's not me being hyperbolic. Now that I've uploaded mine, maybe a little bit more, but they're really hard to find in Panama. And we had amazing opportunities with that bird at eye level, full frame filling photographs. And it was just like my bird head exploded with joy. You know, we saw the wren thrush. We were able to see some of these other birds that we normally aren't going to see unless we're in this tiny little sliver within this tiny little snake-shaped country. And then,
well, and it's not even the snake-shaped country, though, right?
It's just little
like,
mountains
the
inside of it. Yeah,
of these cloud forests, you know. So, anyways, I'm sorry to interrupt. Please go ahead.
No, so it was just in general, it was an incredible experience, and we are in this tiny little part of this tiny little country in this one ecosystem. For that reason, just to see these incredible birds that we otherwise, most people, including us, are not going to see them any other place. I mean, they're just truly a unique and special place, and we saw. As I was saying, a lot of incredible birds, but we did have one special thing happen.
Let me stop you right there, Annalise, okay? Because I think we're kind of getting way ahead of ourselves at the moment here, right? So, like, we should probably explain to people why this is such a unique area, right? You know, this is all about geography. You know, this concept of the cloud forest, you know, it's like, why is it this location that creates, like, what you said? You know, you start using words like endemics and rarities and stuff like that. And I think there's some definitions questions that we should probably throw out there just to kind of help people, you know, catch up to what we're doing here and where we're going. So first and foremost, you know, these cloud forests, like I said earlier, only make up about 1% of the forests on Earth. And, you know, it's all about elevation and temperature, essentially. And it's not that, you know, you hit a certain elevation, you just have cloud forests around the world. It's these very, very, very specific microclimates that happen because of a mixture of geography, usually high elevation mountains next to oceans that kind of block trade winds or the typical kind of flow of weather and stuff like that, that you end up with these areas in the mountains. It's not all the mountains. Like I said, these areas in the mountains that will receive up to or even more than 200 to 300 inches of rain a year. And really, I shouldn't even say rain because it's just really, we should call it precipitation because so much of this precipitation comes from the fact that these clouds just literally bathe the forest and bathe these mountains year round. So much of that precipitation comes in the form of fog drip. So you have elevation, you have the significant amount of just wetness, and you have the simple fact that these are mountains that are sticking up out of an otherwise hot, humid, tropical landscape. And so what that does is it ultimately creates these sort of islands in the sky. You have to have very, very, very highly adapted species to be able to survive in this sort of area. So like in the cloud forest where we were in Panama, for instance, hiking trails, you know, I always think of it as being very similar to hiking around in a place like, let's say, the Smoky Mountains of Tennessee and North Carolina. And visually, it always reminds me of being in the temperate rainforests along the Pacific Northwest coast, just because everything is just completely covered with moss. Everything is just truly dripping with moss up there in this cloud forest. And so because we have these kind of islands in the sky like this, right, what that means is those animals that have adapted, that have evolved to be able to survive in this sort of ecosystem, in this habitat, this climate, this elevation, they can't simply climb down the mountain and go hike over to another country and then climb up those mountains over there. They basically become stuck on top of these little teeny tiny islands. And the amazing thing about that, what that ends up doing for, you know, biological diversity, essentially, is it means that like one particular mountain may have an entire menagerie of different species that cannot be found on any other mountain around it. So this amphibian over here, this orchid over there, this bird, you know, this flower, this tree, whatever, may be rare and endemic and unique in the entire world of those animals, those species, those plants, and only found right here on this one particular mountain. And so, I mean, that was the whole point of this, right? Like, you know, why we focused on going to the cloud forest with this particular trip to Panama is because our stated goal for ourselves is we wanted to go to a place where we could find and photograph animals, birds, stuff like that, that not only had most people never even seen before, but certainly had never photographed before. And I think that, you know, we absolutely hit the nail on the head. We hit a home run with this whole entire trip when it comes to that.
Yeah. And I think it's fair to say it's not that never photographed before or seen. It's just that
I meant rarely. If I said never, I apologize. I meant it's just rarely photographed.
It's kind of one of those once in a lifetime opportunities for most folks. And this was definitely the first time I've photographed most of these birds that we saw. That was, you know, definitely a exciting, like, bird nerd, photographer nerd kind of moment for me. Just seeing most of these birds is exciting for me because of the rarity that they are, not only within the world, but even within Panama. Like, I was talking about that ochraceous peewee, right? You're going to see them, but you're going to see them in the...
Few people get to see them.
Yeah.
And you have to be really dedicated.
You know, well, I was, like, even my friend Sherry, who got to see one when she went to Costa Rica, right? Similar mountain range, this tiny little sliver. I mean, we're talking about a sliver within a sliver across the top of this mountain range, if you look at the species, you know, range map. And even she said, you know, wow, I got to see one, but I definitely didn't get to see one that close and at that level, let alone photograph that bird, you know. And that's even, you know, something that we talked about was just like, I can't believe, like, I was excited to see that bird in the overstory above with my binoculars. I was even more excited to the point that I think I was almost even shaking with my camera when one came down and landed just like on one of the little perches in front of our hide. And so that was just, I mean, mind-blowing to me to see something like that. And I don't know if that'll even happen again. Hopefully, I think so. But that's one of those things as a birder and as a photographer to experience that level of excitement over and over and over again was truly incredible and out of this world.
Well, and a big part of that, right, you know, in the particular area that we went to and worked in, looking for, searching for, trying to photograph these unique endemic species, we were actually working from photography first or photography oriented oriented blinds that were built up in the cloud forest for this very specific reason. And, you know, by working from blinds up there that had been put in place, you know, a year before like this for a lot of these different species, that gave us the opportunity to have this window into the life and times of all of these different species that are so incredibly difficult to find and see otherwise. I mean, your friend Sherry, for instance, with the Cretaceous peewee, you know, it's talking to the local guides that we've worked with around Panama. You know, this is one of those species of birds that, you know, they talk about like, you know, gosh, it's like, I can't tell you how many miles or kilometers I've put down hiking straight up the sides of mountains just to be able to hear the sound or right. the call of this particular species, let alone actually see them, you know? And so I think personally, Sherry was very lucky to come down to Costa Rica for the first time and see one of these species.
Yeah.
And that's why it just simply blows my mind that here we are working with this extraordinarily rare species, you know, in a frame-filling eye-level situation from these blinds that we're working in up there.
The other great thing about working from blinds like this is that you're not just seeing the bird as it is. You're seeing that natural behavior, undisrupted, just going about its business, all of the things that you want as a wildlife photographer as well. You know, you have this situation where this is just that bird living its life and you getting to photograph it. And that's what I love so much about the blinds that we were working with is they were just a part of the everyday landscape and allowed us to have these moments in a very observant and inobtrusive way. And you don't always get that. It can be difficult to find that. So that's another reason that we had some of these special moments is because it was created around the natural world for us to immerse ourselves in their world versus, you know, us trying to manufacture this entire, you know, hunting it down the trail and kind of looking for it. And we got to do it without disturbing any of the natural behavior, any of those other things that were going on with the birds. So I always like that kind of extra attention to being able to get the photograph in a way that is very natural and doesn't disrupt any of the wildlife if possible.
Of course. But you were starting to allude to this like a couple of minutes ago. You know, speaking of rarities, this is the thing that truly blows both of our minds, I think, when we think back to this trip to Panama. You know, here we are in the cloud forest, specifically with the stated goal of finding and photographing endemic species, rare and endangered species. We're sitting in blinds. We're photographing these like really obscure tyrant flycatchers like the Ocracious peewee. And, you know, it's collared red starts and various things like that, which obviously not a tyrant flycatcher, but different category of bird there.
Very adorable.
But we're sitting there. Yes, very like gorgeous bird, actually. Mm-hmm. But we're sitting there in this blind photographing these little super duper rare woodland birds up there. And then all of a sudden there's this flash of white and none other than an ornate hawk eagle, which I guarantee at some point in time during this podcast, I am going to call that bird a hawk owl just because we're in Alaska and we've been looking for hawk owls. But hopefully I won't call it an eagle owl, you know, like the Eurasian eagle owl. But anyways, all of a sudden, a flash of white, this bird, this like just truly extraordinary species of raptor that neither you or I had ever had the pleasure of being able to see, let alone photograph, suddenly comes swooping in and lands literally behind the blind.
Yeah, it was crazy. Like, it wasn't that we just saw an ornate hawk eagle either. We saw a juvenile, which is even more extraordinary because juveniles are even harder to see. I mean, you just don't get to have people in general do not get to have a close-up encounter like we did. So this bird swoops in, lands on a branch and is just looking at us like, hey, how's it going? Just thought I'd come down and say hello.
What up, guys?
Yeah, as casual as anything. And talk about exciting. I mean, this is a beautiful, beautiful raptor. One of the interesting things about this bird and why I keep referring to this bird and classifying him as a juvenile is because like a lot of birds, they go through a few different stages of plumage. And plumage is a really good way to start identifying the age of a specific species of bird. In this case, juvenile hawk eagles have a very beautiful, almost all white head and breast with very little mottling and very little color. And they only stay this way for about the first 3 to 4 months after fledging. So when we looked at this bird, we could easily see that he was only about 3 to 4 months old. And because he was only 3 to 4 months old, we knew another thing because of the way this particular bird behaves. And when you have a young hawk eagle, they only stay about 200 meters away from their nest. That's as far as they're going to go. So they stay within that 200 meter circumference of their nest. So that told us this is a young bird and the nest is nearby. And because this bird is so young, we know that this bird is also still dependent upon his or her parents for a bulk of their food and education. So that meant there were two adult ornate hawk eagles somewhere in the vicinity as well. So
everything
super cool.
Everything about this is rare and unique, right?
Truly.
First and foremost, you know, I've been traveling down to the tropics for over a decade now, never seen one. Hard stop. Just never have. You and I saw a black hawk eagle a couple years ago out on the coast.
Very distant.
But that was like, you know, it's this little black spot in the sky. We were only able to identify it because of the call. That's it. But here, all of a sudden, we find ourselves eye level and only about 30 feet away from this juvenile ornate hawk eagle. So first and foremost, incredibly rare to even see one of these young birds like this. When people think about large raptors in the tropics, especially, you know, specifically the neotropics being the tropics of, you know, the Western hemisphere, essentially, right? Everybody tends to think of the harpy eagle, right? The big, the exciting, the rare, essentially. But harpy eagles are found and photographed far more than ornate hawk eagles are. And the juvenile ornate hawk eagle in this particular kind of color phase, if you will, is just extraordinarily rare to even see, right? Mm-hmm. Let alone photograph. But then add to that the elevation that we were. I mean, again, we are 8,000 feet up here, right? And so when we got back to the States and we're trying to like dive into the research of all this stuff and, you know, find out more about these birds, you know, one of the first things that stood out to me is that Cornell University has never even recorded these birds above about 1,500 meters, which is like, what is that, around 6,000 feet in elevation?
Yeah,
5,900 feet up. And so, you know, here we are at 8,000, and that might not sound much, right? You know, 6,000 feet versus 8,000 feet. But when you're talking straight up in elevation out here in these tropics like this, I mean, we are talking worlds apart, essentially. I mean, that's like saying, you know, yeah, I saw a caribou, you know, walking down the streets of St. Louis, basically. It's mind-blowing to think that that even occurred, let alone it happened to be a juvenile, like you were saying.
Right. And so knowing that this was extraordinarily rare and interesting, we make our way over there and we start photographing. And I think when we were talking about this podcast to begin with, we were talking about how we photographed, like, you know, you fire off like 800 photos of this extraordinarily rare thing. And we all do this, right? We all do this as wildlife photographers. We're like, holy cow, I can't believe this just happened. You know, holy cow, there's in front of me. I've got to just like hold that shutter button down and get the shot, make sure I've documented it, et cetera, right? That's the first thing we start thinking about when something exciting happens in front of our lens. And then it's like, well, I don't really need 800 photos of this bird perching on a stick. You know, you actually want to start maybe doing something a little bit more creative with your photos. You want to make them a little more interesting now that that opportunity is right in front of you. And I think it's something, you know, when we were talking about this episode too, there are so many ways we could have approached this, but we're in that moment and there's this rarity in front of us and it's really exciting. And we don't know how long that bird is going to stay there. I mean, he was obviously very curious about us the same way we were about him.
As so many juveniles usually are, yeah, when we find them in the wild like this.
And we were still plenty of space away, like lots of respectful distance in there. This is, you know, why we use the long lenses, right? So it's not like we're right up on this juvenile bird, but, you know, he's comfortably controlling the situation and deciding where he wants to sit. And he picked a beautiful branch to perch on. But from when we started, we were just, you know, where we were from the blind and had where we had to turn around to go photograph him. You know, it was kind of just a boring photograph.
It's a bird on a stick.
It's a bird on a stick.
It's truly the most boring way that you can photograph a bird in the wild. I'm sorry, hard stop. It's just personally, it is absolutely not my cup of tea.
I understand why. Like, it's nice to have a beautiful portrait, but if you want to frame it a different way, and this is something that I've talked about with other episodes before, is if when you just have that bird could have been in a zoo. That could have been just perched on, like, you know, whatever they call it, like an enrichment or whatever it might be. There's nothing to discuss or like to tell the story of this bird. There's nothing that says we're out in the cloud forest in the photo like this. There's nothing that says where we are. There's no set, there's no setting, there's no depth to the photo. It's just pretty bird on a stick, deep background. And like you said, it's really boring. So once you get that like excitement out of the way and you're, you know, for me, it was just like, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my God. You know, I was really excited. I had tears welling up in my eyes. I was so excited. And that was from, you know, the bird nerd side of me, not the photographer side of me. But talk about like, you know, one rarity after another, and then it caps off with this juvenile ornate hawk eagle flying down to say hello. I mean, come on, how often is that going to happen in my lifetime. This is amazing.
And I think you really hit the nail on the head right there. You know, when you said like this extraordinarily rare thing occurs right in front of us, it lands 30 feet away, eye level, on a stick in the open, right? And there even happened to be a beautiful distant background, mm-hmm. you know, with that particular area. And I appreciate, I just want you to know, you know, for the sake of everybody listening, I appreciate the fact that you use the word we to sound inclusive about just rolling off 800 frames. But really, for everybody listening, what that means is I stood there and took 800 freaking photos of this bird standing on a stick before I thought to myself, wait a minute, I don't like photos of birds sitting on sticks.
I mean, I like having a nice portrait as a birder photographer to say, like, look at this awesome bird I saw. But as a photographer birder, flip it around, right? I want something a little bit more interesting because that bird means a lot to me. There's a story with that bird. It's not just a bird on a stick. This is an individual species that lives in this incredible landscape, has a beautiful habitat. The whole experience is extraordinary. And so we both kind of got into this motion after the excitement, you know, dimmed just a touch. And now it became the excitement of, now let's try to make an even better portrait, a much more storyful and mindful and thoughtful photo. And we approached this in a couple of different ways, but kind of ended up with the same sort of approach, thinking not just about that beautiful background, but trying to weave in a little bit of the foreground. And that's what we wanted to talk about photography-wise in this episode is like, really, yes, you have to be mindful of your backgrounds, but how you can really level up your storytelling as a wildlife photographer if you start to think about the other elements of a beautiful composition and how they can complement your subject, how they can make your subject pop, and how you can make a much more interesting three-dimensional photo come to life in a two-dimensional format. I think this is a really great example of how foregrounds can just elevate everything.
Well, yeah. And so in this particular situation, again, rare subject lands, you know, incredibly curious of us, just something that, you know, we never could have expected, you know. And again, I already revealed my dirty secret. I took 800 freaking photos of a bird just standing on a stick staring at me before I decided to move, you know. So, you know, I've got like 150 photos of like the three-quarter head turned this way and like another 400 photos of the head straight at me and another 100 images of like three-quarters the other way. And I'm a little embarrassed about that, but hey, you know, it is what it is, right? But we've all been there. We've all experienced this, right? You know, we see this thing, this animal, this species, this subject that, you know, we're just super excited about. We throw our lenses up, we start taking pictures, right? Or we start making pictures. And there's, you know, fundamentally, there's nothing wrong with that, of course. You know, it's like, we don't know how long that subject is going to stay there for. We had no way in the world of predicting the fact that this bird was going to fly in. I had never seen one. You had never seen one. As you said, you were literally standing there with tears in your eyes over the fact that this bird just landed in front of us like this, right? You know, so yeah, in these sort of situations, there's nothing wrong with creating what I like to at least call documentary photographs. You know, this bird flew in, you document the situation, you actually got a few images of this bird because chances are that unique, rare, super amazing species that you had no idea, never expected to occur for you is just going to fly off. But in situations like this, where the bird doesn't fly off, where the animal doesn't run away, you know, you've made a handful of documentary images, but you don't need 800 of them. You know, even if you were talking about one of the most compelling and beautiful and story-rich compositions you could possibly think of, you still don't need 800 images of that exact same composition. And so I think that in some ways, this is the psychological challenge that we all face with wildlife photography, you know, kind of being able to have the, let's say, presence of mind where you can, you know, stop for a moment, size up the situation, recognize, okay, I got this shot, right? I got the bird on the stick shot. Now it's time to move about. And, you know, I think that typically what you're going to find is the situation that you first began in, where you first swung your lens up or dropped your tripod down or whatever, it's, you know, 99.9% chance it's actually not the best situation, the best composition. And so once you've grabbed those documentary shots, that's when it's time to move slowly, quietly, respectfully of the subject, obviously, right? But it's time to move. It's time to find different compositions. And Annalise, you know, you brought up foreground elements and how important that is. And I think that, like, I think that we all fall into this trap, you know, in especially in Western civilization, where, you know, we want this kind of silver bullet, you know, that like this one size fits all solution. You know, we want a pill and let it just fix all the problems, basically. And so in general, as wildlife photographers, we often talk about, or we often say things like, you know, it's all about the background. background. And you and I talk about how important backgrounds are all the time on the podcast, in our writings, on workshops and stuff like that. But to only focus on the background, you know what I mean? That's technically what we started with. We had bird on stick and a beautiful background, but it was truly a very, very, very boring portrait of the species. And that's because it takes more than a great background to make a great photograph. It takes more than just good light or just a good subject. It takes a great foreground. It takes a good subject. It takes beautiful light. It takes a great background, all coming together as a part of this kind of equation, if you will. And so, you know, I think the challenge for all of us, again, is to have that sort of, you know, kind of that ability to recognize we got the documentary shot. Now let's see if we can start piecing together all of those different, well, pieces to the puzzle.
Yes. I don't know about you, but I was looking at thinking about ways that I could put more of the environment into the photo in general. Like, I'm very much an environmental style photographer. I like to shoot a little bit wider anytime I can. I like to bring in elements of that environment into a portrait. I like to have a little bit of negative space. That's also very much a part of my personal style. Just nothing wrong with going another direction. That's just how I like to photograph. And so for me, I ended up going down a hill, kind of down to this bottom area and trying to shoot through some branches up a hill and kind of get not quite eye level, definitely lower than eye level, but I was trying to frame the bird through some of that vegetation and have just a more furtive look at this species in my photographs. And I really enjoyed how a handful of those images turned out the time that I had them with the bird, of course, for me. And this was like my biggest frustration. I wouldn't shut up about it after the fact because I couldn't just be happy with this extraordinary experience. I had to be really grumpy about the fact that the shot I had in my head did not materialize as soon as I swung my lens up and got back into a new position to try to execute what I was seeing in my head. That's when the bird decided to fly.
I want to just say I really appreciate the self-awareness there that you were very much grumpy after that shoot.
Well, you know, you're in this incredible spot and it's like you see, and I know everybody listening to this has been in this spot before. You see the shot you want in your head and you know you're about to get it. You're lining up all of the little arrows and you're dotting your I's and you're crossing your T's and all you have to do is click the button. And as soon as I was like, I just switched into a vertical grip and I went to click, and that's when the hawk eagle decided to take off. And I was crushed, Jared. I was so crushed because in my head, I was like, okay, I've got this shot. I've got this shot. I've got this shot. That's pretty. Ooh, I could level it up this way. Let's go. And as soon as I went to like get that like beautiful thing I had in my mind come together, that's when it took off. But that's just how nature and wildlife works sometimes. And that's just the plight of the wildlife photographer. But I was still happy for the experience, but it took me a long time to let go of like missing the shot, especially because I just, you know, I was working through, I was so excited. This was such a momentous thing for me that, you know, I was really bummed.
Well, as they say, if it was easy, everybody would do it, right?
Yes.
But you and I actually both approached that very similarly. Of course, after we got over our bird on the stick, you know, series of images, of course, right? You know, you moved into different locations. You know, you went down a hill, tried to shoot back up to create more environment with that bird. I did not, you know, move back to create more environment. What I saw out of that situation was a tighter portrait with that bird in there. We have different backgrounds. We come, you know, about our photography in different ways. But one thing that we can both agree upon, I think, at least correct me if I'm wrong, is that when it comes to selling our work, environment sells.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You know,
10 to 1, 25 to 1.
Super tight portraits of birds. You know, here's an eye, there's a beak, you know, or here's the head and shoulder portraits, all that sort of stuff. Does the world really need another head and shoulder portrait of this particular species? I don't know. Maybe when it comes to a juvenile ornate hawk eagle, maybe they do, because I looked it up and there's not many out there.
Yeah, there's like literally like 3 or 4.
I was going to say there was like 3, I think I found.
Yeah.
But in general, that's not the case, right? You know, but that doesn't, for me, the way I approach my photography, that doesn't always mean that I then need to, you know, hike 50 yards back and include the top of the trees and the, you know, the roots and all that sort of stuff, you know. And I don't think that's at all what you are trying to say there. I'm just using that as kind of a hyperbolic example, you know. So for me, when I think environmental, I can still create tighter portraits, but I just try to bring in other aspects of the environment into those portraits. So my, you know, the images where I eventually found that I preferred to be the most, right? Similar situation, backed up just a touch, right? You know, but shooting literally through other vegetation in order to kind of create this out of focus foreground element that sort of surrounded the animal. You know, so when we think about the story, the life history, the natural history of these birds, right, while they may nest in the super canopy or the kind of emergent old growth trees that rise up above the rest of the canopy of the, you know, of the rainforest and stuff like that, they actually hunt at kind of the mid-level of the forest. So this is a tangled mass of stuff. These are birds that, you know, you don't find just standing around out in the open. It's not a great egret standing on the side of a bank hunting, you know, in the marsh or something like that. This is a bird that's going to be kind of hidden up in the forest, and it's going to be, you know, especially a bright white bird like this that can be seen by everything in the forest. It's going to be doing everything in its, you know, in its ability to try and hide itself, to conceal itself as it just sits there and waits until something happens to move. Then it drops to the forest floor and grabs it essentially, right? So when I thought of this bird, I thought like, okay, this is a secretive species of raptor, you know? And so if I was out hiking through the forest up here in the cloud forest, you know, binoculars in hand, you know, like a birder named Annalise, you know, you know, this is probably, if I were to actually happen to stumble upon one of these birds, it would probably be just a glimpse of that species in the canopy, you know, in the thick of the vegetation. And so I composed accordingly to kind of help create that story and use that those foreground elements, you know, again, to help tell a story and help create this ethereal sort of look to the photograph. So even though, you know, you move 25 feet around to my right, and all of a sudden you literally just have a, you know, this beautiful, incredible, mind-blowing species of raptor, tropical raptor, no less, you know, on a stick with a great distant background and stuff like that. I move 25 feet to the left of that and set up and shot through the vegetation, and it creates this look and feel as if, you know, we're in the deep dark forest, which we were in the deep dark forest. It's just that we had to actually purposefully, intentionally bring those compositional elements into play there to create this scene essentially. And so, you know, while that is not in any way, shape, or form a traditional environmental image right there, you know, typically when we talk about an environmental image, the subject takes up no more than, say, about 25% of the composition or something like that. And the habitat plays a big role. Even with telephoto perspectives, even with portraits, we are still able to use the environment to tell a story like this. And, you know, foregrounds are one of those things that, you know, are just so unfortunately underutilized, you know, in wildlife photography.
Other ways that we use foregrounds aren't just for story either. They can be utilized for a lot of different reasons in your wildlife photography. So another example, we're getting ready to go to Yellowstone. Utilizing the foreground can make a species that's walking down the road look like they're not walking down the road at all if you're, you know, being thoughtful about it. You can use it to disguise some of the elements that are distracting. You can use it, a properly sort of conceptualized foreground in the right place can frame up your subject. They can really add some color. They can introduce some contrast to the image and help your subject pop more out of the frame. But for me, like just thinking in those layers and trying to take this, you know, three-dimensional experience and have that be elevated in a two-dimensional photo is really where foregrounds come into play. But they have that added benefit of also concealing distractions, of also framing up and making your subject pop, of also helping to highlight the story of that subject. They just take it to a different level. And so it's not just about saying like nice background, nice foreground and the subject, but it's about looking at the entire composition and the entire scenario that you're in holistically and figuring out how to compose them together so that they're harmonious and they're playing with each other and they really help every note in the photograph sound beautiful versus just kind of like isolating each one and being like, well, that's really nice. And this is really nice. And this, and so like, you know, in this musical metaphor, you're looking to create a really beautiful chord that resolves itself. And it sounds great to the, you know, ear, or in this case, looks good to the eye versus just listening to each note individually and saying, that's nice. You know, so it's really about elevating that and creating something really much deeper and much that resonates much more with a viewer than just a simple, you know, portrait or a simple, you know, documentary style shot that like, hey, I got it.
Yeah. And I think you brought up two great points there, right? One, using a foreground element to conceal something something that you don't like about the composition otherwise? And then the other, of course, being three dimensions, right? You know, and so if you don't mind, I'd like for us to kind of just talk on that just for a second here, because the scenario that you started to paint in Yellowstone is such a great example of this. I mean, how many times you and I or anybody that has been to, say, Yellowstone National Park in the wintertime and the snow and all that sort of stuff has found something like a coyote trotting down the snow-covered road in the interior of the park, right? Well, you know, you jump out of your snow coach, here's this coyote coming straight towards you. It couldn't be more boring, right? You know, it's obviously a coyote on a trail. And so unless you are trying to specifically tell a visual story of, you know, how animals utilize roadways, you know, in our national parks and road ecology and all that sort of stuff, you know, then it's just a coyote trotting down a road. But you step off to the side of that snow-covered road, you lay down in the snow, you shoot through, slightly through the berm of snow that's up on the side there. And instead of a road, now all of a sudden you have this white, slightly out of focus foreground element that ends up looking like, you know, blowing snow sweeping across, you know, the landscape, and this coyote walking straight towards you out of that ether of blowing snow. So literally coyote walking down the side of a road or down the middle of a road, as the case may be, in the interior of the park in the winter, and you turn it into something totally different. With our ornate hawk eagle, it was the same thing. You know, yes, this was a wild bird. No, this was not a setup. This was not an aviary. We were not at a zoo. Like, we could not have predicted this. This extraordinary situation just happened to occur on the most set up looking situation. Yes. Like if I were to, like, I, you know, it's like, I got to be honest, right? I don't do a lot of setup photography, but my setup photography looks better than where this bird landed. You know, I mean, this was like, you know, amateur hour. You know, it was like, yeah, there wasn't even any moss on the branch.
No,
I mean, come
on.
It was just
a tree that had, like, it literally just, like, fallen and landed on another tree. So it was, you know, perpendicular.
Right.
And yeah, it definitely was not, yeah, it was a very boring setup if we were doing a setup, but it just happened to be the real thing.
But we were able to then use that vegetation, right, to shoot through it to conceal the otherwise kind of blasé, you know, perch that bird was on, and do so much more. And so, yeah, we oftentimes work foreground elements into our compositions to conceal things that we might not otherwise like about the composition. You know, as opposed to, say, you know, a commercial photographer or someone that photographs models in studios and stuff like that, I can't go out there and tell the ornate hawk eagle what to do. I can't tell the coyote what to do. I have to work with what's at hand in front of me. We all do. And so foreground elements oftentimes gives us that kind of, you know, just a little bit of wiggle room to kind of hide or disguise some of the things that we don't like.
I'm giggling over here because I talk to the animals in my lens all the time from behind my camera. I'm always like, okay, buddy, go over here. Okay, now just turn to the left, turn to the left. Yeah, turn to the left. I know people listening can identify with this because we all do this.
We absolutely all do this.
They never listen. So that's why I was giggling. But you're right. And the other thing I wanted to point out about thinking thoughtfully through the ideas of foreground and background and getting it right in camera is, don't be the photographer. You can be, but I'm just encouraging you to be challenging.
Be the photographer you want to be.
Right. I hate when people rely on, I'll fix it in post. And
heart palpitations right there.
I know.
Where's the aspirin?
And if you're one of those people who finds yourself relying on the I'll fix it in post sort of mantra more often than not, then I would like to challenge you in this coming year of wildlife photography to start trying to use your foregrounds, zooming with your feet, moving for different angles, adjusting your composition in camera to try to get as much of it right in camera as possible so that you're not relying on removing it in post. And I say that just because there are a lot of things we don't necessarily like about our work sometimes, but when you do get it right in camera and you start to see how much more exciting it is and how much more interesting your photography will be when you're not relying on Content Aware or, what is it, the stamp tool? I don't know. I use Photoshop so little.
there is a stamp tool, yes.
A stamp, a cloning or something?
Cloning, okay. Yeah, yes, there's one of those as well.
Okay, so don't rely on those
healing
things.
Healing brush also.
See, I just never use that never use it.
I know, you're all Lightroom all the time.
I am. And they do a horrible job at like trying to content aware, even with the update.
Oh, yes.
But I digress. That's a
whole other show.
Another whole podcast for sure. But I challenge you to try to use some of these amazing compositional elements like foregrounds or like zooming with your feet or like trying to get down low or changing your angle to work some of those distractions or things that maybe you'd be normally, you know, reaching for the lasso tool to get rid of, and try to get rid of it in camera. And I think you're going to find that your compositions and the way you approach your photography becomes infinitely more interesting and exciting because you're starting to nail some of the more challenging things in photography. Anybody can stand on the side of the road and take a photograph with their cell phone, with our fancy cameras, which whatever they are. And so once you start getting past that point with your photography and you start, you know, I've said this before, you start improving, not by leaps and bounds, but by incremental changes. This is one of those. This is one of those incremental things you can do for your photography to help elevate you and take you to the next level. And I get really excited when I see like people in the group posting about those things. I get really excited when we get emails about it, like check this out. I listened to this, you know, thing and I tried this, because the excitement shows in your work. And the difference shows in your work when you're excited about what you're doing and you feel like you finally like nailed something. So that's my challenge to everybody in this coming year, is to start introducing some of these elements into your compositions and see how much you grow as a photographer.
Yeah. And so kind of circling back to the second point that you made about, you know, three dimensions, you know, I do want to touch base on that before, you know, we sign off here and everything. Because, you know, this is one of the things that's oftentimes, you know, like, you know, just in general, that's oftentimes missed in wildlife photography. In landscape photography, you know, it's almost something of a mantra, you know, that people walk around kind of telling themselves over and over and over again in their head, that they have to create a foreground, middle ground, background, foreground, middle ground, background, foreground, middle ground, background, you know. And so much of landscape photography is built around this concept first and foremost, and yet not in wildlife photography for some reason, even though in my personal opinion, I feel like it's actually even more important with wildlife photography. And that's because of the telephoto lenses that we're using compresses perspective so much that we have to go out of our way to try and create the illusion of a three-dimensional situation on a two-dimensional plane like that. So, you know, my challenge for you, which hopefully builds upon yours, which if I can distill yours down means, you know, unglue your feet and move and experiment and visually explore the situation with composition. My challenge is to focus on foregrounds. You know, I think that, you know, if you've been listening to this podcast, if you've been, you know, reading my articles for any amount of time, if you've listened to Annalise talk on, you know, wildlife photography and stuff like that, you probably understand how important light is, how important backgrounds are. But this is the other kind of, let's say, ingredient to the secret sauce, is a great foreground element. Not only does it help to create, you know, depth, dimension, and interest within our subjects or within our compositions, but, you know, if used artfully, it can both conceal things we don't like about our compositions, and it can also work to tell a story with our compositions. And, you know, while we all are photographers for our own reasons, Annalise and I are both professional photographers. We make a living doing this sort of stuff. And when it comes to selling your work, story is everything. You know, that's why I said environment sells images. Environment just equates to story. It helps to tell a story about the life and times and the natural history of the subjects that we're photographing.
Absolutely. And since we're kind of wrapping up here, I did want to touch on something you just brought up, because we have a couple of things coming up. If you are going to be at Imaging USA at the end of January 2024, and you are interested in learning more about selling your work, stop by my talk. It's on Monday morning. I am speaking there at the Conference for Professional Photographers of America. Jared will be with me too. So we'd love to say hello to you. I know there's a bunch of people in the group who have already talked about going. I know we have a lot of listeners and friends and clients of ours who have images in the international print competition that are in the final 24. We're going to be watching that, judging live. Lots of cool stuff going on. So just throwing that out there, because you're right. When we sell our work, the things that sell are always these sorts of images, the ones that have those little bits of extra detail, that have a story, that have some interest, that have depth. All of those things outsell our other work 25-1.
Oh yeah, absolutely. At least 25-1. I agree 100%. And if you get to make a pitch.
You get to make one.
Then
it's
I get
only
to
fair.
Make a pitch
it's
as
only
well?
Fair.
Okay, that's only fair. All right. Well then, if anybody listening to this is interested in joining us up in the cloud forest of Panama, you know, we are going to be going back there in April of 2020. 2024, we will be looking for and specifically trying to hunt for the nest of these ornate hawk eagles. We will be photographing resplendent quetzals, what many people consider to be the most beautiful bird in the entire world. We're going to be focusing specifically on the rare, the endemic. We'll be working from photo blinds. We'll be doing all sorts of different setups and multi-flash scenarios with hummingbirds. And this will be a masterclass in flash photography. Like, you know, you don't need to know flash photography to join, but you will be a certified expert in it, at least in terms of wildlife photography when you leave. That's for sure.
Just to jump on that as well, I think one of the best parts about the Cloud Forest Panama workshop is that when you leave, not only with like mastering flash, but you will understand, like, we don't do a lot of setup photography because we just don't do a whole lot of it. But with workshops, having setups like this is fantastic. And I know a lot of people love to build their own bird setups in their own backyard. So you're going to learn a lot about how to create your own bird studio and how to go ahead and start giving the birds, you know, in your yard, near your home, with your friends, with your other photographers, how to create a studio like that. I mean, the opportunities are endless, but this is a fantastic spot. If you love photographing birds, this is the workshop you want to do.
This is the workshop you want to do. Well, I mean, there we do have another bird workshop. That's Alaska Eagles.
I was going to say, I'm doing Florida birds.
You're doing Florida birds. Yes. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Epic Eagles in Alaska. We do have that coming up in February. We had two people that had to back out.
Yeah, husband and wife had to just recently cancel. They aren't going to be able to make it due to a family emergency. So
okay. Well, if anybody likes eagles, wants to come hang out with us on a boat for 5 days in Alaska at the end of February, which, by the way, it won't be any colder than 30 degrees, most likely, given the location that we're going to be, then definitely want to check into that as well. And so we do have a new website that's up in addition to Photo Wild Magazine. We also have photowildworkshops.com. So, you know, you don't have to go hunting around through my personal website or Annalisa's website or anything like that. You can go to photowildworkshops.com to actually see the list of upcoming workshops that we have and the ones that have spaces available and stuff like that. Anyways, I think enough of the shameless plugs there.
That's true. We have another episode on Panama coming up for you soon. Thank you for joining us with this one. As always, our email box is open for your questions and we look forward to hearing from you.
Yeah, thanks again. Well, folks, that's a wrap for this episode. Thank you so much for joining us.
You can always find us at photowildmagazine.com. And we really look forward to answering your questions. So send those in at info@photowildmagazine.com. I'm Annalise Kaler.
And I'm Jared Lloyd. See you next time.